is Justin Vivian Bond, and I'm an artist. I perform. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I'm also a writer and a painter. And I live in New York City, and we're in my apartment in the East Village.
Great. Justin, when I went to your show on Friday, you performed Nina Simone's 22nd Century, which we were just talking about in the Firescape. Let's imagine we are in the 22nd century today. What is the world like regarding issues of gender identity and sexual difference, for example?
Well, here in the 22nd century, we live in an era where we have rediscovered the importance of honoring nature. And part of honoring nature is honoring the nature of each individual person. And everyone has an individual gender identity, and everyone has their own unique way of expressing their sexuality. Some of it is based on a procreative drive. Some of it isn't. Some of it is more about a creativity that has to do with culture and the social settings and social structures that we live in, so that it becomes more about caring for ourselves and each other and caring for the earth than perpetuating the species, which is very important, but it's not about the need to procreate in order to dominate.
So it seems like we've both lived a long time since we were both born in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. How did we get here? How did we change? Because I remember when I was a teenager and so on, these things were not quite like that.
No, well, things are changing very quickly because the earth has to adapt and people have to adapt. And in order to survive, we had to make some big changes.
When were you born?
I was born in 1963.
And where were you born?
In Hagerstown, Maryland.
What was life like there for you?
It was very rigid. It was a town where people were very conservative, and I think there was a lot of fear-based beliefs, a lot of religious belief, and a lot of religious belief becomes fear-based. I think it has a lot to do with people being afraid of dying or being alone or of the unknown. And certainly when you're in a place without much diversity and where everybody sort of tends to emulate each other in order to fit in, when people step outside of the norm, they become the unknown, and then they are feared. And so I think I lived in a difficult place, but I got out as soon as I could.
How did you come to realize that perhaps your gender identity was fluid or varied, and how did that manifest itself at first?
Well, I was a pretty joyful child. I liked dancing, and I liked expressing myself by wearing things that were glittery and I guess you could say adorning myself. And I was constantly being told that A, I was a boy, and that B, boys didn't do the things that I did. And so I couldn't understand, if I was a boy, why I wanted to do the things that I wanted to do. And so I started to think in terms of not really being a boy. I was aware of the fact that people were trying to put something on me that didn't feel right from a very early age. I didn't quite have the words to express what it was, but I just knew that I was different. I knew that what I felt was true, and I knew that what people were telling me was true wasn't, at least not for me. And so it became a constant negotiation with how I could be true to myself and stay out of trouble and not be harassed. So I started questioning the status quo very early.
And were you at a certain point introduced to this very rigid idea of the gender binary? And did you feel that you were a woman as opposed to a man, or that was something that never came to
No, I never really felt like I was a woman as opposed to a man, although at certain times in my life I felt that it would have been easier for me if I had been born a woman, because I had a much stronger identification with things that are now sort of described as femme. Like I liked pretty things. I was sexually attracted to to boys, and I was friends with girls. I felt most comfortable with girls and most at home with girls, and all of my friends were girls. I didn't necessarily feel, if I could have had, you know, my wish, I probably would have wished that everybody else would have changed so that I could feel comfortable. But at a certain point, I felt that if I could somehow change and become a girl, my life would be easier. And now that I've gotten older, I don't think that's necessary. But I am transgendered, and so I sort of float back and forth. I don't believe in the gender binary anymore, so I'm just kind of exploring a place where I can be as true to myself as possible physically and emotionally.
Did you have, at that early age and perhaps into your teens, certain kinds of identifications from pop culture or literature, for example? Did you find a place in which you saw your identity reflected in some kind of way?
Well, I was definitely comforted by female singers, by the female voice, and by the music that women singers made. And I always enjoyed more of a softer kind of expression. And when I got older, I became, I guess, more angry. So I was, I had an affinity with punk singers like Marianne Faithfull and Patti Smith, people who had a strong kind of subversive message. And of course, I was always attracted to the glamour of Hollywood movie actresses because of the way they dressed, and because I think a lot of them projected a strong image and they had careers. I was always very interested in women writers that would describe their lives, that sort of would write their own narratives, like Lillian Hellman or Joan Didion, people that had very strong voices and who seemed to determine their own path.
Were you already aware at this point of the political dimension of gender issues?
No, I wasn't. I didn't really become aware of gender politics, aside from feminism, which I was very interested in. From the time I was maybe 6 or 7 years old, I was aware of feminism, and I believed that in my child's mind, feminism was saying that men and women were equal. And so I thought if men and women achieved equality, then it wouldn't be so important for men and women to stick to their gender assigned, their assigned gender roles. But I think that feminism kind of lost track of itself in a way because of their own homophobia. When a lot of lesbians got involved with feminism, it became a kind of a rift in feminism, and the mainstream culture kind of played up that rift. And then there was the fight for the Equal Rights Amendment that was in the mid-70s, and that was voted down. And then I became more aware of the opposition. And then in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected, primarily because he catered to a fear-based Christian voice, the moral majority sort of came in and hijacked American politics. And then I became aware of their determination to make sure that people remained ignorant, that they wanted to cut education, that they wanted to start arguing about science, and sort of taking everything from a logic and turning it into this kind of, you know, crazy dogma that was based on faith, that had no basis in reality, and in which religion and politics became basically the same thing. The separation of church and state started to be eroded. And then there was the AIDS crisis, which was sort of the wake-up call for people of my generation, because it became queer people of my generation, because it became very clear that our government wanted us dead and would do nothing to protect us. And that's when I think, that there had been the gay rights movement that started in the 70s or even in the 50s and before, but it became much more popular and people started coming out and fighting after Stonewall. But then people began to literally fight for their lives in the 80s, and I got involved in Queer Nation in San Francisco, and I met Kate Bornstein, who's a playwright who put me in her show Hidden Agenda and started to give me the words to articulate my gender and my ideas of how I wanted to express myself. And so then I became much more political.
When did you turn to performance or to art as a way of making a life?
Well, I was always interested in performing. I always loved singing, and I grew up in a church in Maryland that was very accepting of me, even though they didn't quite know how to accept me. But I felt safe there. I wasn't harassed or attacked. And so I would do a lot of performances with the youth choir and Christmas pageants. And then I got involved in community theater when I was in my teens. And so I found that when I was painting or drawing or writing or performing, I was in control of what I was presenting to people, because if I would be walking down the street or if I was at school, I never knew how I was being perceived. But when I was on stage or I was performing, I knew exactly what I was putting out, and people seemed to respond positively to what I did. So I never felt safe in a crowd, but I've always felt safe in front of one.
When did you get out of Maryland?
I graduated from high school in 1981, and I was gone 3 days later.
And where did you go to?
I went to spend the summer working at the beach in Delaware, and then I went to college.
Where did you go to college?
Delphi University in Long Island in New York.
And later on, you moved to San Francisco, from what I understand.
Yes, I graduated from college, and I lived in New York for a while, but I wanted to be an actor. I thought I wanted to be an actor. And I didn't want, I had been trained, so I knew I had the technical skills to be an actor, but I hadn't really found a voice, or really, I wasn't completely sure I was talented. So I wanted to go someplace where I could get work and really find out. So I moved to DC, which was near where my parents lived, and I started working there, and I did some shows, and I discovered that I did have talent as an actor, but I didn't really want to be one.
What kind of shows were you doing? Other people's shows?
Other people's shows. I was cast I did some dinner theater, and then I was in a play about the Siamese twins, Chang and Ang, in a summer theater festival down there, and I was one of the Siamese twins, and it was a real acting challenge, and I was proud of the work I did. And then I got called back for the Folger Shakespeare Company, and I did these auditions, but by the time I got that audition, I was really ready to move on. And so for my audition for the Folger, instead of doing a traditional audition piece like, you know, Lysander or one of the sort of like young leading men of Shakespeare, I decided to be Cleopatra. So I went in and I did Cleopatra for my Folger audition, which they said was very interesting, but which did not get me cast in the Folgers in their season. But then shortly thereafter, I moved to San Francisco because I was going to try and establish residency in California so I could go to a state school and get a degree in art history. And then I met some other queer performers and discovered that queer performance was where I could have a voice, and I started creating my own work.
So it seems like in Washington already you started to understand that perhaps expressing ideas of gender identity on stage could be a way of making work.
Well, I don't know if it was so much that. I think what I discovered was that I wasn't interested in trying to figure out what other people expected of me. So for auditions and for the what I needed to do in order to be a successful actor. I realized I would have to really step outside myself and become something that was calculated to please other people, and I just couldn't live that way anymore.
And when you come to San Francisco, at what point do you realize that you could use your body as a form of expression, but then also more importantly, perhaps as a political instrument of sorts?
Well, I had always had a lot of internalized homophobia because of the way I was raised. And when I moved to San Francisco, I found a community of queens that were the first time I had found a group of other boys that were not expressing themselves in ways that were oppressive to me. And I began to discover that by loving them, I was able to love myself. And so then I just started to just free up my body, freed up, and I let my hair grow, and I got my ears pierced, and I started wearing different clothes, and I just became much more androgynous, and eventually became a lot more comfortable with my feminine side. And then I started to feel attractive for the first time in my life, and I started to just blossom in a way that was very visible, because I was not trying to hide, but I was actually expressing myself. And by being someone who did that, walking down the street 24 hours a day, I became, I had always been stared at because I was different because of the way I walked or for various reasons. I remember one time my girlfriend said, it's so strange to walk down the street with you because everywhere you go, people stare at you. What is that like? And I was so surprised that she even said that to me, because I had become so used to just not paying attention to how I was being perceived at all, that it was a wake-up call, because I didn't realize that I was really looked at. And so I realized too that I was making an impact, and just by walking down the street I was making a political statement. And I remember one time I was walking down Market Street, and some guy screamed at me, "Hey baby," because I was looking very femme, and I don't know if he mistook me for a girl or for a tranny, but whichever he was, you know, coming on to me. And then I sort of ignored him, and he screamed, "Bitch!" And then I turned the corner, and someone else started calling me faggot. So on one corner I was a victim of misogyny, and on the next corner I was a victim of homophobia, which are really the same thing. But I thought, you know, no matter where I go, it's confusing to people. So, and it was not so confusing to me, but I thought, what's wrong with people, you know?
When you say that you connected with a group of queens in San Francisco at the time, are you referring to drag queens or people that were not necessarily...
Some were drag queens, some were just, you know, outrageous, really empowered queer boys that were, you know... smart and assertive about who they were, and weren't making apologies, and weren't trying to be gender normative gay men, which I never really liked, that were sort of like, weren't like muscle Marys or sweater queens. They were more sort of like anarchists, or a little bit more punk or aggressive about who they were, but yet very funny and very lovely, not aggro in any way, but just accepting and pithy.
But beyond that performance of gender of sorts, a fluid kind of identity of this group, how did you come to terms with your sexuality? I mean, with your sexual desire? Was that something that, if you feel comfortable speaking about that?
No, I guess that part of being comfortable with your sexual desire is getting to a place where you can allow yourself to feel desired. I think I became more comfortable with my sexuality when I became more comfortable with what people were desiring in me. So, you know, I felt in order to be a gay man, I had to act certain ways for other gay men to be attracted to me, which I wasn't really comfortable with. And I also knew that straight men weren't necessarily wouldn't be attracted to me as a gay man, or so I thought. So I was constantly trying to figure out how I could be attracted to other people. And when I finally just became myself and people were attracted to me, then I became more comfortable with my own desire, because part of the exchange is it's desirable to be desired, but it's also it's an exchange. So I found that I was attractive, and then I could find, once I was comfortable with the fact that I was attractive, or and that people were attracted to me, then I could become more aware of who I was actually attracted to in a way that would satisfy me, as opposed to just some sort of objectification of some ideal, which, you know, I think most teenagers go through. But I then started to look at people as human sexual beings instead of like pictures in magazines or whatever.
How was the scene in San Francisco at the time in terms of public spaces, public sex, kind of a, yeah?
Well, there were places, there were sex parties, and there were, you know, there was a lot of cruising in parks, and there was sex in clubs, but it wasn't, the places that I went weren't necessarily places that were a lot of public sex, you know, dance clubs and queer clubs and things like that. Like, you could totally make out with people and get off in the bathroom or whatever, which I always enjoyed. But when I moved to New York in the 90s, there were still back rooms and lots of the bars and things like that. But I've always had more of a desire for intimacy. So I would do acts of public sex on stage in clubs, which I thought was fun as an exhibitionist. That was exciting, but I wasn't really into, and I was in control because, again, I was on stage, but I was never really comfortable in a kind of like dark back room having sex with someone that I wasn't really sure, you know, I wasn't sure what was going on. I guess I don't know if it was whether I was too insecure or whether it just really, it just didn't for some reason appeal to me very much.
In terms of your performance, you meet your collaborator Herb in San Francisco, right? Mm-hmm. How does this come about, and what kind of work do you start doing at the beginning?
Well, I was dating this boy, and I wanted to do a lounge act because I loved Julie London, and I was really interested in that kind of like classic 50s glamour, and I loved sort of the songs of the kind of back rack era 60s feel, that kind of lounge thing. But I also wanted to update it and sing modern like indie rock songs within that style. And so I was trying to find someone to work with, and I was dating this boy, and he said, oh, you should talk to my friend Kenny. And so I went over to Kenny's house, and we played some Jacques Brel and some Leonard Cohen songs, and we just practiced for a while and hung out and got to know each other musically. And then I got a gig doing a show which I wrote called Dixie McCall's Patterns for Living, which was a show where I played myself, and it had this little conceit that my cousin was, I was filling in for her. So I started out trying to do her material, and it didn't work, and then I did my own. And it was very successful. And so we started performing around under our own names, Justin Bond and Kenny Melman, doing lounge versions of popular and rock music and straight and gay clubs in San Francisco. And one night, this guy asked me to perform at his birthday party, and it was raining, and I was really tired, and I had been going through this kind of being a transgendered person, dealing with fags that were constantly, they had their way of approaching transgendered people and approaching drag queens, and there was this whole stereotype that drag queens were bitchy and mean, and I always felt like they were casting me as that, which I really wasn't. I was always being treated in a certain way that I found offensive because it just had nothing to do with who I was. So this particular night, I was smoking some pot, and I was angry because someone had said something to me that hurt my feelings or whatever. So I said, all right, if these queens want a bitchy, fucked up diva, I'll give them one. So I put on this makeup and this scary wig, and I drew lines on my face, and I put on, and I never wore, I never wore fake boobs or anything. And I put on these great big knockers, you know, and I showed up at this party, and I just came out like I was drunk and I was crazed, and I just did this performance of this over the top, insane, crazy queen. I mean, and I just wreaked havoc at that party, and of course that they loved it, and it was fun because it was cathartic in a way. So I played this character a few times just for fun, and then I hosted the main stage of the Festival of Pride at the end of the Gay Pride March, and as myself. And then that night we had a gig, Kenny and I had been marching in the parade, and I had been singing and screaming all day long, and I just really didn't have much of a voice. And I said, all right, well, tonight we're gonna do our material, and I'm gonna be Kiki, and you're gonna be Herb, and we're gonna be this down and out lounge act, and we're just gonna go for it, because I can't sing and I can't be pretty tonight. So I did the character, and it was in this straight club, and all these people just went crazy for it. We got a standing ovation, and I thought, okay, well, let's do more of it, because it gave me an outlet. It was much easier for me, to be honest. It was easy. And I was at a time where a lot of my friends were dying, and I had all these things that I wanted to say politically that I felt would have seemed shrill coming from a 28-year-old. And so I made, at the time, Kiki was supposed to be 66. So I was this kind of seen it all, done it all, alcoholic woman. And I felt like I could get away with making a lot more of I could make more political comments and say a lot more in this humorous way, that I was far enough detached that it wasn't so earnest, and I could get everything I wanted out without alienating people. So I used Kiki as a mouthpiece for my political agenda.
And what was that political agenda then? Do you remember the types of things?
Well, I could rail against Reagan, I could rail against Bush, I could rail against the war, I could rail against homophobia by creating a gay son for myself, for instance. I could talk about issues, women's issues, as a woman who had been had her children taken from her because she was too wild, or I could just kind of, and I could say them in this crazy way that would A, confuse people, but they would understand what I was saying because I was drunk. And I you know, like one of the classic lines was, the saddest day of my life was the day John Hinckley missed when he tried to assassinate President Reagan, you know. And then I would go off in this diatribe about Reagan, and it was funny, you know. So,
and what was Herb's character modeled after?
Well, he always said that, when we did our first show, Dixie McCall's Patterns for Living, we did it in this Greek restaurant on Valencia Street, and there was this great Mexican pianist there named Eddie, who was just beautiful, and he was old, and he would sit at the piano and drink tequila and just play piano all night. And he was, you know, he's like real show busy, but a sweetheart. And he had this cat that he loved, and his cat was dying. And whenever he would start talking about his cat, he would start crying. He was the sweetest thing. And and he was just, you know, kind of a little downtrodden, but had this great spirit. And so we sort of based Herb on Eddie.
How long were you together? How long did you perform together?
We performed together, I believe, from 1991 until 2008 or 2009. It's been 2.5 years. So yeah, 2009, I guess, beginning of 2009.
And do you separate because you find that it's time to move on?
Yeah, for me it was time to move on. I couldn't really see what else I wanted to do with that character. I had taken her from, you know, clubs in San Francisco to Carnegie Hall twice and to Broadway, and I had made the story I'd expanded the story from her them being born in 1930s to them being born before Jesus, and and that they were now immortal because I brought in the narrative after doing this person's life for 70 years. I thought, oh well, so then they were in the manger, and it's this long story, but the cow in the manger ate the afterbirth of Jesus, and the cow was then immortal, and Kiki and Herb drank the milk of the cow, and the milk of the cow, unbeknownst to them, made them immortal as well. So they had been alive throughout, you know, the previous two millennia. So I was able to place Kiki. She went out on dates with Hitler. She had been in France for the French Revolution, so I could make all these, you know, jokes and stories about any time throughout history after the birth of Christ, which was fun.
But did she eventually die, or is she still alive?
Kiki?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. She's
resting.
Yeah. She's gone on. They reinvented themselves, so I think that they reinvented themselves and are living somewhere else. They weren't lounge singers for 2,000 years. Every now and then they'd get discovered, and then they'd have to go underground again. So I guess that's where they are.
And then you continue to perform as Justin Bond.
Right.
And how is Justin Bond different from Kiki? I mean, I know it's a different persona, but in the way that you're approaching both singing and politics.
Well, obviously Kiki was very over the top and was a story that wasn't my own. I'm now, you know, just being myself, telling my own stories, but also I created this voice for Kiki, which was distinct and uniquely her own, that character's. And so getting back to working as myself, I decided that I needed to rediscover my own voice, and I did that through songwriting. So I started writing my own songs and choosing carefully who I collaborated with. And so I've been working with a variety of musicians. And I love the structure of cabaret, which Kiki and Herb was basic, you know, classic cabaret structure. So in that way, the similarity is that I still operate in the same classic cabaret structure of, you know, song story, and, you know, build a set in such a way that it, you know, it hopefully doesn't get boring. So within that structure, I sing my own songs and I tell my own stories, and then of course I am free to integrate all the work that I do. So I've been writing, and I have more time because it took a lot of energy to maintain that character and to get into that space, which I inhabited for a very long time. So she was angry, and she was frustrated, and she was loud, and she sang in a way that it's not my natural voice, the Kiki voice. So it was nice to not have to be as hard on myself. So I'm a little bit more gentle with myself, and I think my shows are a bit gentler.
One of the things I enjoy about your shows is how you, when you sing songs that are not your own, mm-hmm. in a way you queer the content of this song, and mm-hmm. there is something that happens to a Nina Simone song or a Karen Carpenter song that is, it provides a completely new reading, mm-hmm. and it's that space of identification, you know, like I had it with Karen Carpenter when I was a boy, mm-hmm. like I really wanted to be her because mm-hmm. I just identified in every possible way.
Right.
And your performance makes that possible again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I really appreciate. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, it's a lovely thing because it wasn't something I was sure I would be able to do. And obviously my identification with the Karen Carpenter and with other singers of the time was very real. And so when I sing those songs, it's with a real love for the songs and a love for the person who sang them originally, but it's also a way of, like you say, the identification is genuine, and so it makes it my own, so I don't feel like I'm emulating anybody, but I feel like I'm taking the spark of inspiration from what they did and sort of letting it and live within me, and then sharing it with other people who can also identify with those characters. Karen Carpenter, who she was very, I think her, my theory is that she was a victim of the gender wars. Her parents favored her brother over her. She was a tomboy. She became very insecure about how she was looked at. She became this huge star and was brought out from behind the drums, where she had become a great drummer and was now placed under this microscope. And the only way she could control her life was by controlling her body. And she did that through the way she ate and the way she dressed. And I think she tried very hard to become this idealized woman, which is, again, looking outside of yourself to form yourself. And I think that can be crippling. And in her case, it killed her.
Another thing that I've noticed in your performances is that you are much more overt about presenting trans as a wonderful opportunity or as a fantastical space and as something that is looked upon as in a positive light.
Mm-hmm.
When does this start to happen in your performances? The script, I'm much
well,
more
well, that started to happen
script.
Many, many years ago. And I think that was part of the frustration of the way that was received, and how I was young then, so I didn't have, I think, the conviction or the strength to continue with it, and I didn't have a lot of role models for how, and so I think, you know, I always say that Kiki was a capitulation. It was easy, and I always felt that even though I, Justin, am a lot gentler and a lot less in your face, I feel that what I say is a lot more of a challenge to people than what Kiki said and how I presented Kiki. Kiki was easy because people felt that they could recognize and put what that character was into a box. And I think it's much more difficult to do that with me. But on the other hand, I'm in a place where I have a greater love and a greater capacity to express that, and I'm not as frustrated by people's inability to receive it. And so, just it's better for me now. And it was something that I was always interested in doing. I just wasn't quite sure how, and now I feel like I am.
It seems like you have a much more demarcated, strong degree of confidence, and so does your audience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so it's a different time.
Because your audience is more prepared to hear the things that you're saying,
yes.
Even if they...
The younger generation of queer people is much more comfortable with gender fluidity. Because, you know, we always felt, well, we didn't realize it at the time, but in the early to mid-90s, it was sort of thought of as the golden age of queer publishing, because there were all these publishing houses that were publishing queer literature. All of a sudden, you know, Michael Warner put out Fear of the Queer Planet and his book The Trouble with Normal, and then there became these queer theory courses in universities, and they were talking about things that we, some of us, knew and we experienced, and that was our lives, but they were sort of bringing it to an academic level and giving it a certain amount of I guess you would say mainstream validity, or at least they found a way of explaining these ideas to a mainstream academic audience, and then that also trickled down, and so then of course the publishing industry collapsed, and so the golden age of queer publishing was over, but the queer authors and writers had found their voice. And so younger people have now had this kind of these ideas as part of their education, and they've expanded on it, and they've been validated by it. And so I think I am speaking to a new audience and a younger audience that gets what I'm saying, and I learn from them, and I'm validated by them, and that gives me the strength, and vice versa. So it's a kind of a really great exchange. So I'm so grateful that I have people that are, you know, let's say 20 years younger than me, that are in their 20s, that I can relate to much more deeply and profoundly than a lot of people my own age.
I've been here for 15 years, and I did when I first came, there was a bar called Bardot, mm-hmm. where Joey Arias and other people were performing. And when that place closed, it seemed like that, you know, drag, gender bending underground really collapsed,
mm-hmm.
Especially throughout the Giuliani and Bloomberg mm-hmm. years. But I do agree with you that recently it seems like it's very much alive. There mm-hmm. is a gender bending performing scene happening mm-hmm. again. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that in that time, you know, RuPaul became very successful, and RuPaul had a great voice and a great message, but it was very drag, it was very over the top, it was very fashion driven, but there became a lot of work for quote unquote drag queens in New York. And so, you know, I somehow was in that scene, but on the side of that scene, because Kiki, that character, was in a more of a theatrical and a show business cabaret setting. I never lip synced, I always sang with my own voice. But when I moved to New York, I found it easier to wear boobs, and I did take the easy way in a certain level. But also, I would say, you know, like, I never really identified as a drag queen, but I never denied being a drag queen because I love drag queens. But I would, you know, always introduce myself when I hosted at clubs like Foxy or Cake or just Cream, just places that I would. I would always introduce myself, "Hi, I'm your tranny hooker hostess," because I actually felt like a tranny hooker in those jobs, because I was strictly in drag for the money, and I had a lot of fun, and it was like a role I was playing in that space too. And also, having had so many of my girlfriends in San Francisco who did identify as drag queens, they died, and they were very sex positive, much more sex positive in public. I mean, I'm very sex positive, but as far as like public displays of sexuality, transgressive sexuality, they were amazing at it. And then they all died, and I sort of felt like, well, I'm just gonna pick up where they left off. So I would do a lot of performative sexuality just to honor and carry on a tradition that I felt was being lost and was truly under attack by the Giuliani administration, and also by queers in New York who decided that they were going to police sexuality in the gay community, and were also instrumental in getting a lot of public sex places closed down in New York. So I felt like, even though I wasn't someone who had sex in a lot of those public places, it was very important for people to be able to make a choice. And so I felt like queers who were trying to close queer sex spaces were the equivalent of fundamentalist Christians who were, you know, pro-life. And so I felt like I had to take a political stand through my nightclub work.
One of the things that is interesting to me is to see the change in the LGBT movements, kind of the official LGBT movement's agenda in terms of pressing issues that concern the community.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, relating to what you're saying, one of the things that I've seen happening is how that agenda has totally mainstreamed and normalized the underground, mm-hmm. to the extent that perhaps thinking of the underground it's not a valid notion anymore. And that's something that worries me. What are your thoughts on the underground and its relationship to politics?
I think that it is an interesting thing, because what is the underground? I don't know. I mean, sometimes I'm still described as underground. I don't think of myself as particularly underground. I'm a downtown artist because this is where I work, and there's a certain aesthetic that goes along with that, I guess, which is basically that we operate without any sort of financial support whatsoever. We aren't supported by corporations. We have no government support. Once in a while, maybe someone will get a little grant to do some work, but we aren't subsidized. So therefore, we're what, underground? And we're hardworking and committed to art, and to making our art, and to making our statements. But I don't really know what an underground is at this point, because the underground means it's difficult to find. I mean,
exactly.
with YouTube and with Facebook and with the ways of reaching out to our communities and our potential audiences, I don't think anyone can really take can claim to be underground unless they've completely gone off the grid and they're doing some performance in some cave that only the natives know about and only a few of them. That's the only way I can see being underground.
But what about an idea of the underground as a way of life? Like, for example, you also identify yourself as a radical fairy, I imagine, and I've been to several fairy gatherings over the years. That is, in a way, an off-the-grid way of life, isn't it? Would you think that there is a queer scene that is outside of the mainstream radar at this point?
Yes, I think so. There are people who live that way, but I still don't know that they're, I mean, I don't know that they're necessarily off the grid, because people are still wired to the internet.
They're coming in.
Yeah, so there are ways of opting outside of the sort of traditional economic system and living ways that don't require so much connectivity, either specifically to like public resources like electricity and sewage, if you you know, if you want to live in that way, which it's a wonderful way to live and to raise your own food, but I'm sure that those people still have to have car insurance or whatever.
But there is something about your recent performances, I'm referring in particular to the one you did at the Kitchen in the Fall. What was the title of the performance?
Regally Blonde, A Sissy Fix.
Right, in which you do present as a kind of you know, futuristic, utopian understanding of trans beings. So that I guess that notion is still in some way idealized.
I believe in it, and I idealize it, and I think it exists. I mean, the show was based on these people called the Gali, who were the gender variant priests of the goddess Sybil, and they're historically they existed, and they lived in a way that was they traveled and they honored nature, and they lived outside of the mainstream, and they lived outside of the gender binary, and they were obviously cast out of society at a certain point, specifically when Christianity came into vogue, and the last temple of the goddess Sybil was burned in Rome by the Christians in like 285 AD or whatever, and up until then they had been a mainstream part. The goddess-based religion, specifically the goddess Sybil, was sort of like the greatest competition for Jesus and for Christianity outside of Judaism, and the Christians burned the temple, and then they sort of outlawed that kind of the Gali, and looked down on that kind of gender variant behavior, and that's, I think, where homophobia really began. And so those people that have chosen to live that way have existed throughout history, throughout time, and continue to exist. And I think that we're sort of the ancestors of the Gali, because even though, you know, we live in the city and we have electricity, I think we're aware of an alternate way of living, and I think that's been somehow in the queer diaspora, we still managed to get together and pass on information to each other, and I think it's a wonderful gift to mainstream society that we do.
Do you feel represented by the mainstream LGBT movement?
In certain ways, I mean, obviously, I think it's wonderful that they're fighting for visibility, and they're trying to get health benefits for partners. And I mean, personally, I've been a big believer in just a kind of socialized medicine for everyone, and then it wouldn't matter whether you're queer or you're straight or you're married or you're single, that, you know, to qualify for benefits by, you know, insisting that your marriage is valid. Well, I don't think that anyone should have to get married in order to have health benefits or anything like that. So, I mean, on a certain level, I think that, yes, they're fighting for specifically queer, for a gay agenda. I would like to see it be more social justice for all than struggling for specifically gay people, but I think it's great.
Well, what about trans organizations that are working for trans rights?
Well, I think it's great also. I mean, I think that it's wonderful that they've just changed the law, I think in New York, or maybe, no, in the federal government, that you no longer have to have surgery in order to have your gender confirmed by a doctor. So that's great. It's making it easier for people to have their gender changed on their passports. And once your gender's changed on your passport, it becomes easier in smaller local ways to get your gender changed. But of course, the gender choices on the passport are still M and F. And if I write male or female, either one, I'm lying because I'm neither. So I would like to see a T in the box. Or a T in a circle. Let the other two be boxes. I'd like to have a T in a circle.
You recently added a prefix to your name, took on also the name Vivian. Mm-hmm. And
Mixed Justin Bond instead of Mr. Ms. or Mrs. Right. It's Mix, which I like.
And you also exposed an idea of the kind of pronoun that you would like to be referred to. Can you explain this process that perhaps you can finish up like that?
Sure. I can tell the story of... I always just sort of went with he because it was easier. And I'm at a point where I'm more confident to assert what works for me. I thought, well, if the choices were he or she, what's the point in getting everyone to call me she? And then, of course, there have been attempts at language by people throughout time to find gender-neutral pronouns. And I was at speaking at a conference on sex and gender, and person who was introducing me asked me how I would like to be pronounced, and I was like, I was sort of flustered by the question, and he said, well, how about if I call you they, because Genesis Peorage likes to be referred to as they. I was like, okay, try they. So there were two people who spoke ahead of me, and then when he got to my introduction, I had sort of forgotten about the conversation, and he started referring to they and looking over at me, and there was someone sitting next to me, my friend Beth, and I was like, who is he talking about? And then I realized that I am they, and I thought, oh God, that really doesn't work for me. And so I thought about it, and there's Z, and there's here, and there's all these different ones that felt awkward to me, and I decided that I was going to be Justin Vivian Bond, because I felt like it was a more rounded expression of who I was. And I thought, well, I'll be V, because I like V, because the way it's written, it's two sides and they're of equal strength and they're united. And so just the way V looks, and I sort of like V because in French, V is life. And so I thought, well, I'll just have V be my pronoun, because I think it's easy to say V, and it's something that doesn't sound like he or she. As far like Z sounds a little bit like it's a little confusing. So I just decided I would be V.
Coincidentally, you're also starting to do, you mentioned in your show, estrogen therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you doing this now?
Well, I have been thinking a lot about, you know, obviously throughout my life I've kind of been gender fluid, and sometimes I identified more male and more female. But when I was younger, as I was saying earlier, I didn't have a way of really expressing my transness. And I've been very aggressive about saying that I'm trans in my work and in my life. But I didn't have any sort of, there's nothing other than my word, people can take nothing other than my word for it, and which is fine, but I started to think about when I become older, and when maybe I won't have the strength or the energy or the mental facilities to constantly be asserting my transness. And so I decided that it would be easier for me to start making a public record of my transness and having a medical record of my transness and having my body be a record of my transness, so that when I'm older, you know, there, hopefully in 20 or 30 years when I'm an old person, there will have been a lot of changes and there will be a lot more room for trans people in sort of like the medical establishment or in places where we go to be taken care of when we're old. And I do not want to be lumped in with the old men. And I would prefer to be probably with old women or old trans people. So I just decided it was important for me to have a physical and medical record of my transness. Not so much for now, but for later.
For the 22nd century.
For the 22nd century.
Thank you, Justin, so much.
Thank you.